The Guardian.
The joy of ebooks is that great stories are just a click away. For our podcast listeners, we have a great offer on Luke Harding's book Mafia State, a menacing tale of life as a journalist in present-day Russia. I'll tell you more at the end of the show.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
I doubt that anybody who works in a drug company, I doubt that they could punch an old lady in the face or drown a baby. But when you distort or participate in the distortion of the clinical evidence that doctors and patients use to make decisions, that has a real-world impact.
Ben Goldacre will be along to discuss his new book, Bad Pharma, which is crying foul when it comes to how the pharmaceutical industry pushes out positive trial data and makes negative trial data disappear. Also, an area where positive bias works, when we invite The Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample and Observer science editor Robin McKee to discuss this week's science news. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Now, the one area where positive bias works is when we invite Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample and Observer science editor Robin McKee in to discuss this week's science news. Welcome, gentlemen. That was a tortured sentence, wasn't it?
That was a great intro.
I think it was
absolutely fabulous. My eyes were watering.
Ian, can I start with you? So there's been some sort of genetically modified cow that's eaten the world or something? No, it's got some allergy-free milk, which is exciting.
Yeah, people have made... genetically modified cows before, and they've even made them to try and make the milk hypoallergenic, allergy-free, which is similar to the work done here. But this was a New Zealand group that used a technique called RNA interference, which is a very kind of specific and subtle technique that you can use that instead of completely sort of knocking out a gene in an animal, which might cause you some other problems down the line, this allows you to kind of fine-tune the genetic expression. So what you do is you put genes into the cow, which cause the cow to produce small molecules, which then interfere with the machinery inside the cellular machinery that would produce certain proteins. And in this case, it was to produce a whey protein that would cause people allergies when they drink milk. Now, it's interesting because this is one of the first times people have shown that you can use this RNA interference technique in large animals. It's been done in plants, it's been done in mice before, but so is a heck of a lot of stuff that doesn't work when you move up to bigger animals. And although you probably wouldn't actually use this technique to produce allergy-free milk, what you can do is, and what people are starting to look at with this technique is trying to come up with pigs, cows, sheep. Something's been quite close shown with chickens, where you can try and make them more resilient to infections from viruses.
And so it's more of a proof of concept than actually a way of producing allergy-free milk. I mean, I'm assuming there are better ways of getting either allergy-free milk or just avoiding milk if you've got allergies.
Yeah, or Daisy, as the cow is known, is grazing nicely at these paddocks. And she'll be bred for and going into further studies and so on. But if you wanted to make allergy-free milk, you can do it after the fact. You can process it after the fact, or you can try it. You can knock out the gene and make it, and that can be a very clean process. But what this really is doing is showing you can do more precise control over genes, and that is actually the bigger issue here.
Okay,
Robin, if it was so good, how come she wasn't born with a tail?
This is a really interesting issue. I'm glad you raised that. No, she was born. And another issue to raise, actually, is that there was a very low efficiency in this because it uses the similar cloning technology as was used for Dolly the sheep, where you're taking a skin cell, you're putting a genetically modified nucleus into that skin cell, and then you're putting that into a foster animal. And of more than 100 blastocysts, these like balls of 100 cells they put into females, less than half led to pregnancies. They only got one live birth from a cesarean, and Daisy was born without a tail. Now, they're looking into what may have caused that. The most likely reason is that it's an artifact of the cloning technique, because as you know, with cloning, the first generation using SCNT, somatic cell nuclear transfer, you can get these things called epigenetic changes, which can cause this kind of disruption.
Wow. I don't know how to react to that, to be honest with you. The epigenetic changes are one of the reasons why human cloning is always going to be very difficult and incredibly ethically challenged. And the efficiency rate still, it's amazing that after 12 years or so, maybe more after Dolly the Sheep, you know, the efficiency is still very low. But then you don't want to clone entire animals, do you, really? It's not...
What you want to do with this is move on, and this is where the work is going, is you move on so you don't have to do the cloning. You move on so that you do the genetic manipulation directly in the embryo. And interestingly enough, in the same issue of the journal, there was a paper showing that you can start to kind of do this kind of thing through some of these genome editing techniques we've talked about before.
Okay, so RNAi was a Nobel Prize-winning technology idea. Let's talk about the Nobel Prizes. They're going to be announced this week. By the time you've heard this podcast, at least one of them, the Medicine Prize, might have been announced. So let's not make any predictions. We're not going to make any predictions, apart from one. Ian, why is Peter Higgs and whoever else not going to win this year's Physics Nobel, which will be announced on the Tuesday of this week?
Well, the funny thing is that because the Higgs was such a big story this year, a lot of people in the sort of around the business of in the media are saying, well, it's got to be a Nobel Prize for the Higgs. And it's actually really unlikely. It's not impossible. The Nobel Committee, the Physics Committee, could go out on a limb and do something they've never done before, which is give a prize in the same year that some kind of confirmation came for it. But I don't see why they would feel pushed. They don't tend to be pushed by the ages of people. They tend to really research these claims. And the thing is, the rule book says that the award goes for something that was at least been published a year before. And the proof that's come isn't a proof yet. I mean, there is no paper that says we found the Higgs yet. There is a paper that says we found something like the Higgs, but there's nothing there yet. And remember, nominations were in February.
So for many reasons, it might not work. And you say they could go out on a limb, but this is not a risky committee. This is not a committee that decides to do things quickly. I mean, it took them however long to give Einstein a prize in the first place, given his various successive achievements. I mean, Robin, the rules of the Nobel Prize committees are arcane beyond belief sometimes.
Yes.
And stop what you think it might happening. Stop what you think might happen from happening.
Yes, it's interesting. When Nobel, when he kind of made his legacy, he said he wanted these prizes, and he left it to committee, and they made up the rules. It wasn't Nobel himself who said it, but a couple of them are causing real problems nowadays, and one is a maximum of three, and that is a real problem nowadays. And when you engage in science, that way you look at the numbers of people just involved in tracking down the Higgs, it's hundreds.
Thousands of names
going on, and you know, how on earth do you reward something of that nature? The other one was you don't give it to people who are dead, and you know, which I suppose once you're down that road, I think we're going to have to stick with that one. Otherwise, there'll be all sorts of
posthumous
problems.
Claims.
The kind of one that really gets me is it's the awards that are not given to people who have really upset the scientific apple cart, the people who have just gone out just that little bit too much on a limb, who've said too many outrageous things about topics outside their own remit. And, of course, the classic example is Fred Hoyle. Now, Fred Hoyle is a scientist who came up with the idea of nuclear synthesis. This is how do the atoms, any atom heavier than a carbon atom, come into existence. When he was on the go, there were two theories about the nature of the universe. Was it steady state, i.e. eternal, and always and continually going, and little atoms of hydrogen would keep popping up. Intellectually, kind of more interesting than the other idea, which is the Big Bang theory that says everything exploded into existence 13.2 billion years ago, and coalesced into the stars and planets and humans that you see nowadays. The point is, where do all the heavy elements come from? Steady state, of course, was proved wrong, but it was proved right in one other way. Where do all the heavy elements come from? People who supported the Big Bang idea said it was all created then, and suddenly when they went back to the calculations, it showed that the universe expanded too quickly for that, and we had to find another way of explaining the heavy elements. And Fred Hoyle led the team that showed that it goes on inside the hearts of stars. Two hydrogen atoms form a helium. Helium forms into carbon, into beryllium, and all the way up. And then the star explodes, and these atoms are spread across space and coalesce into the metals that make the microphone into which I'm bubbling away here. The thing was that Fred Hall led the research, but he also said maniac things that we were all later on that evolution wasn't right, our star, our Earth was being bombarded from microbes from outer space, etc. So the Nobel Prize gave it to the rest to one of his team members, but not to him. And even though he was the lead author, so it can't be that the research was not worthy of a Nobel Prize because they gave it to his number two. But they didn't give it to him, so that meant, I'm sorry, man, you've got a big mouth, shut it.
Yeah, well, he was a cantankerous git, though.
He was amazing.
He was hated, wasn't he,
I've got a lovely quote here from Sir Harry Croteau. Apart from, this is Hoyle, apart from his earlier work, his arrogant, misplaced assumption of his own genius, together with his blunt northern stubbornness, of which he was so proud, caused him to be wrong so often on high-profile issues that people have forgotten when he was right. Oh. And that's, in a sense, what he paid the price for it.
You're right, outrageous. But then this reminds you of two things. One is that science is done by human beings, who can be a bit mean. But also the Nobel Prize thing is incredibly political and judgmental and all sorts of things. And it's got this reputation as the sort of finest prizes in science. And in many respects, it does do that. But even Einstein had problems getting his prize.
Well, the interesting thing with Einstein was that he was nominated year after year for work on, you know, the relativity theories. But because they were so contentious at the time, that the committee was so conservative and thought it would get a real roasting if it gave the award for relativity, that they never awarded it to him. And so a Swedish scientist, I believe he was Swedish, sussed this out and then nominated him for the photoelectric effect. And then he got the prize for that. What went on after that was interesting as well, because Einstein wasn't around to go and pick up his prize in the year he was given it. So a year later, he turned up in Gothenburg to give a talk there and spoke on relativity, whereas, of course, that became his kind of equivalent of his Nobel lecture. But, of course, when you give your Nobel lecture, you're supposed to talk about the thing you get the prize for. So even then, he brought a pile of stress his way because of that.
But didn't he win his prize not only for the photoelectric effect, but general contributions to science? I mean, it was a bit of a fudge, wasn't it?
Yes.
They knew that they had to give him the prize for something. But as you say, general relativity wasn't factually proven until 1919, when Eddington found all these parallax of the stars and everything. But you're right, that one of the greatest scientific theories ever constructed by a single person, and no one believed him. But then, would you? I mean, the question is, it's so strange. General relativity, special relativity, such strange things. We've had a century to get used to them. They're still quite weird and strange things. I mean, 15 years doesn't seem too long.
I suppose he could have won it for about five different things.
And he could have
They said, well, nobody likes a smart aleck.
But you're right. Relativity was a genuine revolution. And find me, people, outside of physics who understand relativity genuinely. I mean, it's not an intuitive thing.
No, it's not intuitive.
But the thing is about Nobel Prizes, once you've got the Nobel Prize, you are just then become some kind of semi-religious, iconic figure. So that's kind of hands down, all sorts of utterances that are taken by the public as God-given.
Well, I don't want to be harsh, because what did Einstein do after he won his prize? He didn't do any other contributions to science.
Albert? Yeah, special relative. What did Albert Einstein ever do for us?
I'm ashamed that I just said that. Thanks to Ian Sample and Robin McKee there. For more news, go to guardian.co.uk/science. And of course, if you're going to follow the Nobels, we're going to live blog all of them. On Monday, it's the Medicine or Physiology Prize. On Tuesday, it's the Physics Prize. And on Wednesday, the Chemistry Prize. Join us for the whole thing live. Ben Goldacre is a doctor and lecturer in epidemiology. He's probably most famous for his Bad Science column in The Guardian. Week after week, he skewered dodgy journalists, quack cures for serious illnesses, and people who abused statistics. His first book, Bad Science, rallied a growing nerd army, who have used blogs and Twitter to hold bad science to account ever since. Ben's next target is the pharmaceutical industry, namely how drug manufacturers massage the trials for their products, how the medical and scientific professions are either woefully underinformed or tacitly complicit about it all, and how patients suffer the consequences. He came into the studio to tell me more. Ben, thank you very much for coming back on the podcast after how many years?
8 million.
8 million years. That's a fact. That's a scientifically proven fact. So tell us how a drug is licensed in the UK.
Okay, so I think almost a more important question is, how do doctors and patients decide what drug to use to treat a medical problem? Because the bar to get on the market is actually very low. In a lot of cases, you only have to show that your drug is better than nothing, which is a very low bar. A lot of people think they know what a randomized controlled trial looks like. They think it's you do a comparison of a new drug against a dummy placebo sugar pill. But actually, that only answers a very boring abstract question of, is this treatment better than nothing? In reality, we want to know, is this treatment better than the best currently available treatment, the one that we're already using? We don't care if it's better than nothing. We want to know which drug is best. So the problem arises at the very beginning of the approval process, in that regulators will very commonly allow drugs onto the market with only evidence showing that they're better than placebo. A third of all of the drugs that came onto the market through the FDA, for example, from 2000 to 2010, were only shown to be better than placebo, even though there was an effective treatment on the market already. So there's a very, very low bar. So drugs will be trialled in maybe a couple of trials of several hundred patients, maybe a couple of thousand patients' worth of data in total. Often they'll come onto market also only with trials looking at something called surrogate outcomes. So they're kind of theoretical outcomes. You'll look at a change in blood pressure or a change in a reading in a blood test rather than a real world outcome like disability or suffering or death. And that's, again, partly a function of the need for companies to get their drug onto the market as quickly as possible while they still own the patent. So they need things that will change very quickly. And so it's very easy to show that your drug changes blood pressure levels or changes cholesterol levels. But one of the problems with medical research, of course, is that people take a long time to die. So you have to wait a long time if you're going to do a long-term trial that follows up to see whether your drug, which is ultimately supposed to prevent death, for example, does actually prevent death. So drugs are very commonly licensed with poor quality trials in the sense that they make irrelevant comparisons. They compare a new drug against a dummy placebo sugar pill. They look at surrogate outcomes, which aren't informative for everyday use. But then finally, there's a third problem, which is you can show that a drug is effective in maybe 2,000 or 3,000 patients, but you can't necessarily detect side effects. Because if there's a side effect that happens in only 1 in 1,000 patients, but which is very important, then it's quite possible that you'll completely miss it in your trial follow-up data that only lasts for 6 months and only covers a couple of thousand people. So that's why when you're taught how to prescribe at medical school, you're often told, don't prescribe new drugs. Unless they're really fantastic, then, you know, let other people take the chances. Regard the whole of the rest of humanity as unpaid stunt doubles, because you're often comparing something which has only been shown to be effective on a surrogate outcome in 3,000 people for 6 months, and you're comparing that against a treatment which, you know, might be a little bit less effective, but we know that tens of millions of people have taken it safely and we know that it has a real-world benefit.
Now, emotionally speaking, brand-new drugs always imply to people who maybe aren't are wise to these things something cutting-edge, amazing, it's going to make everything better. This is something you're saying that, you know, doctors are trained not to pay attention to.
Well, we hope, but in reality, we know that doctors very commonly do prescribe whiz-bang new drugs. And that's partly because, of course, doctors and patients fetishize the new. And also new drugs are very aggressively marketed by drug companies. And there's a really important context for this. There's a fantastic systematic review that's it's either just come out or it's about to come out. I've got an advanced copy by Benjul Begovic. And it looks at the very simple question, when a new drug comes out and it's compared against the old drug, what are the odds, just completely a priori, for all new drugs against all old drugs, what are the odds that the new drug will be better? And it's just above even. So, you know, that's not evidence that you would use to inform every single prescribing decision, of course, but I think it's incredibly relevant background information for the extent to which we fetishize new drugs and the extent to which we're wrong to.
So ideally speaking, a drug goes through several phases of clinical trials, the data is reported to regulators, the drug is allowed, and then doctors get information about the effects of these things and prescribe them, you know, in an informed fashion. Now, your book wouldn't be your book if you didn't sort of imply that wasn't quite happening.
I prove that in
your own way. Let's take a drug, let's say like Tamiflu, and tell me what happened to that drug and how that idealized structure that I talked about wasn't applied.
Okay, well, with Tamiflu, this is a drug which governments around the world have spent billions of dollars on stockpiling in the belief that it will reduce the likelihood of people having complications after having influenza. And complications, of course, is a medical euphemism meaning pneumonia and death. Now, the evidence on whether it does that or not is still being withheld to this day from the Cochrane Acute Respiratory Infections Group. We know that, so just very briefly, Cochrane is an international non-profit collaboration of academics who produce gold standard systematic reviews and summaries of all of the evidence on a given medical question. And we know that publication bias is a huge problem. We know that negative trials go missing in action. We know overall that only about half of the trials that are ever conducted ever get published. We know that trials with positive results are about twice as likely to be published as trials with negative results.
And that's why you do systematic reviews, which is to take lots of trials and pool the data together.
Well, no, because when you do systematic reviews, that's when you're hindered by this, because that's when you're summarising a biased sample because you're seeing positive results, but you're deprived of negative results. So knowing that this is a problem, Cochrane, of course, has now begun going to drug companies and going to regulators and saying, we have concerns that there may be some trials that are not adequately published. We have concerns that there are trials which have been published only in very brief summary form, but we need more information to know if they were methodologically appropriate, because, of course, not every trial is necessarily a fair test. There can be flaws in the design of a trial, which means that it is biased or vulnerable to bias, and so more likely to give a positive result for the drug. But also we know that some trials can go completely missing in action, completely AWOL. So the Cochrane Acute Respiratory Infections Group got in touch with the drug company and said, we would like to have all of the clinical study reports, which are the long form of the results and the methods for all of the trials that you've conducted on Tamiflu. And what they have discovered is an absolutely staggering mess, and a mess which we've every reason to believe generalizes to a great many drugs, if not potentially all drugs that have ever come onto the market. So firstly, it's very clear that completely different sets of trials were reported to different regulatory authorities. That the company themselves don't seem to be able to give a consistent account of what trials have been conducted. So when you ask one office, they say one thing. When you ask another office, they say another thing. But also, as I show in the book in great detail, citing peer-reviewed academic journal articles describing this monstrous disaster, really, the company is still withholding this information from Cochrane and giving the most extraordinary reasons for doing so. I mean, they sort of say, oh, well, we don't like the look of you. We don't want you to be able to have our information to analyse.
What about regulators? Surely regulators can require this information.
Well, so that's a very, very interesting issue. The immediate comeback that you get in a 90-second discussion on this issue from the pharmaceutical industry, for example, is, oh, we are one of the most tightly regulated industries in the world. We have to give all of the information to regulators. And that sounds superficially plausible. The problem is, firstly, we know, and there are many, many stories on this in the book, that people don't always report all the trial data to regulators. But secondly, we know that trial regulators withhold the information that they do have from doctors and patients. So the European Medicines Agency, for example, in one particularly scandalous story described in the book, spent 3.5 years refusing to hand over to the Nordic Cochrane Group the clinical study reports on two widely used anti-obesity drugs, Orlistat and Rimonabant. And this was the subject of a 3.5-year-long battle involving the European Ombudsman, who made a finding of maladministration against the European Medicines Agency. And during this episode, the European Medicines Agency raised the most bizarre and extraordinary objections to sharing this information with Cochrane and therefore doctors and patients. And you have to remember, you know, doctors and patients need all of the evidence about the results of clinical trials in order to make informed decisions about whether a treatment is appropriate for them, whether it's safe and effective. The European Medicines Agency very simply took industry's side. They said that the results of these studies contain commercially sensitive data, which is clearly untrue. I mean, and even if it was true, it would have to be considered proportionately alongside the needs of patients. Secondly, they said that the clinical study reports contained identifiable patient data, and this is something that they raised 2 years into the battle after they had already tried and failed to convince the European Ombudsman that this information was commercially sensitive. And the European Ombudsman finally got hold of the full reports and said, well, that's ridiculous. You know, obviously, it's very easy to strip out this information. It's a trivial thing to do. So this is a 3.5 year long battle of the European regulator, who now cover drugs in the UK. They are the people who approve drugs to the market for use in this country. 3.5 years, they battled to deliberately withhold information about the safety and effectiveness of medicines from doctors and patients. Now, that
in all
me,
that time, the drug was available.
Well, in all that time, the drug was available. And fascinatingly, the European Medicines Agency said to Cochrane, well, it's for you to prove that we are putting patients at risk by withholding this information. And then staggeringly, 3 years into this battle, one of these two drugs was taken off the market because it did more harm than good. It increased the risk of suicide and death. Now, that's an extraordinary, extraordinary episode. And it amazes me that this isn't front page news. And I think the reason why it isn't is it's to an extent protected by a force field of scientific complexity, if you like. I mean, it takes about 5 minutes to get to the point where people understand why it's a problem. And a 5-minute pitch to explain why large numbers of people are suffering and dying unnecessarily, unfortunately, turns out to be, excessive for our, you know, our current means of raising public awareness of serious and important problems like this. But this is a flaw at the absolute core of the information architecture of the whole of evidence-based medicine. And it's a peculiar, I mean, what I describe in the book is a complex interlocking ecosystem of problems that all reinforce each other, and of which this is only one. And in every single case, there are people who I suspect probably aren't necessarily evil people. I mean, I doubt that anybody works in a drug company or the European Medicines Agency. You know, I doubt that they could punch an old lady in the face or drown a baby. But when you distort or participate in the distortion of the clinical evidence that doctors and patients use to make decisions, that has a real-world impact. People suffer and die unnecessarily as a result of those actions. You know, it goes without saying that all of the stuff about drug companies hiding data, researchers hiding data, regulators withholding data, that's all, to my mind, plainly unethical and very, very simply avoidable. But I think there's also a second problem, which I also talk about in the book, which is a kind of failure of ambition on the part of evidence-based medicine, on the part of doctors and patients and politicians. Because in the NHS, for example, we have in our electronic health records a resource that could be harnessed at very low cost to compare the relative benefits of treatments in widespread use and optimise care on a daily basis. We could minimise harm and we could maximise benefits and turn the NHS into this enormous testing and learning machine that would produce valuable information that could save lives, not just in the UK, but by producing results that are relevant to everybody everywhere in the world. So, for example, I'm involved in a trial that's running as part of GPRD, the General Practice Research Database, just been renamed to CPRD, actually. And the idea of this trial is very straightforward. We know that the trials that get done are often too small. We know also that trials are often done in unrepresentative patients, in ideal patients. We know that trials are very expensive, and so they don't run for very long because they run as standalone administrative projects. So our project is very simple. There are two statins currently in widespread use in the UK, atorvastatin and simvastatin. Nobody knows which is best. So we know that they're both roughly the same at reducing your cholesterol levels. And we know that they've both been compared against nothing to see if they're better at saving lives. And they both are. We know that they're both safe and effective because we know that they've both been used by millions, if not tens of millions of people around the world for many, many years with no problems or no great problems. The benefits hugely outweigh the risks. But nobody's ever compared the two in a head-to-head test. And if it turned out that one or other was only 1 or 2% better, then because heart attack is so common, because raised cholesterol is so common, because there are so many people on statins, this would represent an enormous money and life-saving exercise.
And you can do that if you've got data from people taking this across the country.
Okay, so what you don't want to do is just rely on collecting electronic health records from people who are already being prescribed these treatments. Because the problem there is you can never be sure that the people on one drug or another drug are perfectly comparable. It may turn out, for example, that posher, healthier people for some reason get put on one drug rather than another. It may turn out that some patients with certain medical problems which predispose them to having a shorter life expectancy get put on the drug which has some kind of mythical a priori sort of mythos around it that it's safer. So paradoxically, the safer drug might appear to be less effective. So you can't rely on that. What you need to do is randomize. And so the objective of our project is to see how seamlessly could you embed a randomized controlled trial comparing these two statins that are already in widespread use, already known to be safe and effective. How seamlessly could you embed a trial like that in routine clinical practice? So the ideal is you go along to your GP. He says, well, I think you need a statin. This is just a normal practice. And then when he goes and tries to prescribe a statin, a big red screen comes up and it says, wait, we don't know whether atorvastatin or simvastatin is the best. Press this big red button here to randomly assign your patient to one or the other, and you'll never have to think about it ever again. And never having to think about it ever again is really crucial here, because the thing that makes trials expensive is you have to get people back in for extra follow-up, do some special cholesterol, you have to track them down, see if they've had a heart attack, measure their heart performance, whatever. But with electronic health records, we can suck all of that follow-up data out of routinely collected administrative records that are there anyway. So you get it for free and forever, for the whole of the rest of their lives. You can see if they have a heart attack. You can see if they die from ONS data. You can see what their cholesterol is opportunistically. Now, it's not blinded, and research is always about trading off strengths and weaknesses on practical and ethical issues. But actually, I don't believe that that's a major issue here, because I don't believe that patients necessarily have very strong beliefs that simvastatin or atorvastatin is best. But that is one small flaw. Now, this trial can run for about £500,000, which compares to $120 million for the All Hat trial, which is a reasonably comparable project from America. So it can run for almost nothing. And more importantly, it's just one example of the kinds of trials that we could be doing routinely throughout the NHS. I mean, to my mind, whenever there is uncertainty about which of two treatments is the best, I think that doctors and patients should routinely expect that they would randomise, and then we would find out as quickly as we possibly could which treatment was best.
Now, this is some of the promise of legislation that's being sort of discussed at the moment around sharing of NHS data, right? And coming in the next few years, hopefully the idea is that maybe, well, at least the Conservative government, the coalition government rather, does want more sharing of NHS data, sort of anonymised data which can be used for better health outcomes. I mean, this is a thing that I know you're supportive of. Well, let's go back to the sort of central message of your book, and the sort of the more positive ends of this. Well, if you can say the beginnings of the positive ends, you've got a whole list of paragraphs for different audiences, for what they can do next. Do you want to take me through what you think the most important bits of that are in terms of doctors, patients, and even you've got advice for pharmaceutical company workers? What do doctors and patients, first of all, need to be doing?
Well, a lot of this I've covered already, I suppose. I mean, firstly, I think every doctor who hears this should get onto their professional membership body and say to them, I think in our code of conduct, we should include a statement saying that not publishing clinical trial results is research misconduct. I think that's a really important basic place to start. And I think every doctor and every academic should write to their professional membership body, should table a motion to that effect at their next annual meeting, and make sure that that gets onto their organisation's statutes. Because, publication bias really is the cancer at the core of evidence-based medicine. It makes a mockery of everything that we do. We try to reduce the bias in clinical trials as much as we possibly can at all times. And then After all of that effort, I mean, why do we even do randomised trials in the first place to get unbiased results if we're then going to allow all of that bias to creep back in?
Have you done this for your medical organisation?
Yeah, well, that's a really, really good question, isn't it? So I was thinking that as I as I wrote the end of the book just about 6 weeks ago. And you're right, I haven't, and I'm going to. I mean, to be fair...
Which one is yours?
To be fair, I'm not a committee man.
Go on. What's which one's yours?
So for me, it would be British Medical Association. I'm a member of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, although I don't practice.
Okay, so those two groups need to start waiting for a letter.
They can expect a stern letter
from... Go on then. Patients. What do patients need to do?
Well, actually, there's one other thing that doctors can do, but I think patients could possibly provoke them to do it. I think patients could possibly invite their doctors to post up in their waiting room a little polite notice saying whether they see drug company sales representatives, whether they accept drug company sponsored education. And I think that would be a useful and interesting thing. I actually don't think that the marketing side of things is the most important part of the story of how evidence-based practice is distorted, but I think it's a real issue. But I certainly don't think that patients should drive a wedge in their relationship with their doctor. I mean, I think that's sort of by the by, really. I think
there is that danger, of course, of if you arm this is going to sound ridiculous when I say it, so I'm aware of that. If you arm them with too much information, then the doctors will spend 95% of their time sort of saying, "Hang on a minute." They're just arguing with their patients about what to do for treatment when there should be sort of a more joint consensus.
Well, so actually, I mean, something else that I talk about a lot in the book, which isn't just drug companies are assholes, rah, 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 and it's not even just doctors and academics and patient groups are dreadful. You know, there's a lot in there about the things that we need to do to sort of raise our ambitions in evidence-based medicine. And one of the most important parts of that, I think, is to get better at disseminating clinical evidence to the people who use it and need it in better forms. And actually, you know, if you put me in charge of medical research funding for the next year, I would cancel all primary research. I would cancel all clinical trials. And I would spend all of the money exclusively on better mechanisms for disseminating the evidence that we already have to doctors and patients, and better mechanisms for ensuring that evidence is implemented in the best possible way.
Your pitch to David Willetts?
Well, you know, amongst other things, I have discussed this with him actually just last week. I think it's really, really, really important. You know, for the cost of just one trial, you could move that project forwards in leaps and bounds. And there's really fascinating and very, very important work being done in, for example, the shared decision-making literature, as it's called. And it's best done, I think, in areas like oncology, where sometimes you see clinicians who will sit down and talk through survival curves with patients. They'll say, you know, you've had this lump removed. This, from patients like you in the past, this is your survival curve if you have this treatment. This is your survival curve if you have chemo plus tamoxifen. This is your survival curve if you just have tamoxifen. These are the possible side effects. Let's talk through in a very concrete way with this information whether or not you'd like to choose any one of these treatments. And actually, I think that the future for medicine, really, as we have increasingly rich information but an increasingly wide range of treatments, the future for medicine really is in doctors being kind of personal shoppers but also the interface between their patient's instantiation of a medical problem and this vast edifice of information.
That was an extract from a much longer interview, and we're going to put the whole thing out as a Science Weekly extra sometime later this week. For more information on all of Ben's writings, go to his website badscience.net. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. And remember, join us live on the blogs for coverage of all the Nobel Prizes this week. But for now, from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For a limited period only, we have an exclusive ebook offer for Guardian podcast listeners. Guardian columnist Luke Harding's Mafia State is a dark and ominous insight into the life of a journalist in present-day Russia. We're offering 30% off the list price of $4.99. All you have to do is go to the ebook store www.kobo.com, that's KOBO.com, and at checkout put in the discount code MAFIASTATE for your Guardian podcast offer.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.